the day went on, the weather turned dark and it was pouring rain again. Speedgoat ran the last section in the rain while Ricky and I found a laundromat. He said Jerker's clothes smelled like apple cider vinegar, a fact I had been ignoring for the past week or so. Not uncommon for ultra-endurance athletes. I knew it meant he was breaking down acids in his body, that he was tapping into his reserves, or something worse. He completed the 4-state challenge plus 6 extra miles and was soaked through. Since Ricky was leaving the next day, instead of drying off and jumping in bed like he should have, Scott wanted to spend the evening drinking a beer with his friends. I wanted him to sleep, but even more than that, I wanted him to enjoy this little slice of normalcy. Carl eventually went to bed, but the three of us stayed up late sitting in our van talking about everything but running. At some point late in the night, a car pulled up. It was two ultra-running French photographers, Alexi and Roan. I have no idea how they found us out there, but we laughed at the randomness. They were going to try to find a hotel and then meet us tomorrow morning. The rain didn't let up, and Jerker was grateful for the clean, dry clothes to start day 23 with the Frenchies. Carl left to take Ricky to the airport. Roan was running with Jerker, and Alexi followed me to the crew stops, sleeping in his car whenever possible. I knew he must have been hungry, so I offered to drive into town with him to get food and gas. I looked up a grocery store and led the way. A few miles from the trail, the terrain got more urban, and weirdly, I recognized the strip malls. Why did they look familiar? Had I been here before? Suddenly, it hit me. I was in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, and this was the road Jerker and I drove to find the AT a few years ago. It was surreal. It's hard to explain, but back when we first stepped on the AT, it seemed pretty basic. I didn't understand Jerker's reverence for it. But now, knowing what I knew and after everything I'd seen, felt, smelled, and experienced since stepping foot on it in Georgia, it blew my mind. Just a few miles beyond the strip malls and neighborhoods lay this unassuming trailhead, a portal to a whole other world, like Alice's rabbit hole. We'd been living a different life in a parallel universe, so close to the rest of the world, yet so removed. I thought about the AT's proximity to major cities up and down the eastern seaboard. Half of the U.S. population lives within a day's drive of at least one of these rabbit holes. We got food and drove to the next meeting spot. Alexi fell asleep in his rental car. I walked to the trailhead and found a fluorescent sticky note that read, "You got this, Scott. Halfway." When Scott arrived with Roan, we said au revoir to the Frenchies, and I ran the next stretch with Jerker. We were alone and anticipated what was coming, so we ran fast and with purpose. After about a mile, there it was. The official 2015 Appalachian Trail Midway Point sign. Holy shitballs. There were a lot of runners waiting for Jerker at the AT Museum in Pine Grove Furnace State Park. The rain was torrential, but when Scott got there, the excitement of crossing the midway point gave him extra energy and he was running with ease. He left with a handful of runners and I was alone again. I wandered around the state park and drove to a lake somebody had told me about. It was completely empty because of the rain, but luckily, just then, the storm started to break. I jumped in, and as cliched as it sounds, I felt all my cares slip away as I floated on my back and stared at the rapidly clearing sky. We made it halfway. We had a crazy 1,095 miles behind us, and another 1,095 to go. We had everything we needed, each other, and that was enough. I closed my eyes, held my breath, and felt the water get colder as I sank below the surface.
Chapter 10. Running Through the Sticks with My Woes. Day 25.
"Dude, it's the frickin' Forrest Gump show out here," Speedgoat grumbled. "Virginia and Maryland were nuts. Don't know how you're doing it, man. All these people would drive me insane. Well, they are driving me insane, and I'm not even the one doing 50-mile days. We gotta ditch that GPS tracker, delay the live feed by a day or two.
I just kept running on the AT treadmill, acting like I was working too hard to give an answer. Speed Goat wasn't wrong. It often was a bit like the Forrest Gump show. With the weekend in full swing in Pennsylvania, there were lots of people in addition to the countless rock piles. On the one hand, it was hard to be on and working my butt off, while also answering questions and letting people join me. I often wondered how much energy and time I was expending by opening my record attempt to whoever wanted to join in. Most professional athletes wouldn't even consider letting strangers play alongside them in a championship game or match. On the other hand, I wanted to be myself, the approachable guy who hung out after races for the last finisher, the guy who stayed at events well after the venue had closed to answer questions and pose for photos. It was by no means easy, but that was me. And all of these people were part of my tribe. The hip-hop artist Drake describes his tribe as his woe. Woe is my crew. It stands for working on excellence. It's just my whole brand and my whole movement and my way of life for everyone. I want everyone to work on excellence. So all my friends are my woes, and I feel anybody working on excellence in life is a woe in life as well. To me, anyone who runs or mindfully moves their bodies is working on excellence. Could J.Lew and I get the record while still sharing our experience with my woes? For the time being, I was managing to do both. I'm sure I wasn't perfect, and people coming out didn't know what mental or physical state I would be in. They had to take what they got. My tribe wasn't coming out only to catch a ride on our train. They were also providing material support. One family brought us 6 grocery bags filled with plant-based rarities. Cheese and meat substitutes, non-dairy ice cream, and other items that were hard to come by. The outpouring of support and generosity was humbling. Locals wanted to help in any way they could, and as we got further north, the trail came closer to larger cities and population centers. We appreciated all the donations, but J.Lew had a hard time finding room in Castle Black's limited storage. Managing the company of strangers was physically and mentally draining on J.Lew more than on me. She was the one who was bombarded at trailheads. She was the one who had to answer questions when she was trying to prep things for me. She was the one who was interrupted when she was taking a nap. I felt bad for her additional woes. While it was hard to measure the costs and returns, I knew that even though I was giving life energy to complete strangers, I was also receiving a form of energy. It was another give-and-take relationship with a cycle of working on excellence. What I gave was returned to me in the form of inspiration, motivation, and perspective. As I ran down a ridge at sunset, my thoughts wandered away from the rocks below my feet to the amazing people I'd encountered on the trail the past couple of days. The crowds at trailheads, 20 or 30 at a time, a lot of them bearing inspiring signs with some quotes from my book, "Pain Only Hurts," and "Be Somebody." They were giving me a dose of my own medicine. A local cross-country team met me in the late evening darkness of rolling farmland in the Cumberland Valley. And during the day, parents brought their little explorers to run a mile or a few yards with me. Then there were the big hits of unexpected inspiration that made me realize my struggles on the trail were nothing in the big picture of life. One local runner came out and told me he was there to run 30 miles with me. My initial reaction was an internal cringe. 30 miles is a long way to go with a stranger. And then he told me about the hellish year he had just been through. He'd been diagnosed with leukemia and had almost lost his life. He was my age, had a wife and kids. It was easy to put myself in his shoes. The 30-mile run with me was a gift he was giving himself, a kind of celebration for getting through it. And here I was, feeling bad about my torn muscles and rocks and roots on the trail. My day was transformed. Perspective can be both humbling and inspiring. Those 30 miles wound up being the easiest of that whole stretch. It was becoming increasingly clear to me that I wouldn't even come close to the record without the fans, friends, and supporters who were showing up to run with me. The trail was torturing my body every day. Finishing, let alone owning the record, was coming in and out of focus daily, even hourly. But the presence of other bodies, other minds, and other stories made my pain feel like a part of something bigger, and something I couldn't complain about. There were a lot worse things I could be dealing with besides boulder fields and tropical storms. As we crossed the Delaware River and left Roxylvania behind for a brief trip through New Jersey, I made sure that Jalu and I ran together. We loved hearing the accents change along with the geography, and we laughed as we did our best to replicate lines we had heard from locals. We needed that time together. Time she didn't have to spend cooking for me, feeding me, scouring my body for ticks, bandaging me, or otherwise tending to my basic needs. Time to simply be a couple. Not a couple fixed on the big goal. That was hard to balance, and occasionally I wondered if we were drifting apart rather than coming together. I got the sense that her spirits were flagging, even though she and Speedgoat had become buddies to the point of mutual admiration. How that had happened was a mystery, yet it also seemed meant to be. She was sacrificing so much to be out here supporting my FKT attempt. On the outside, it appeared to be all about me, but we were a team working towards something we both needed, something beyond a record. That is, if we actually got the record. I had made up ground by adhering to the Speedgoat principles of averaging 3.5 miles per hour on the AT treadmill, and nickel and diming my way to Katahdin if I had to. But I was still just barely clawing back to a record-setting pace. The ground I'd lost in the South over just 2 days was taking me weeks to regain, but I was doing it. I was starting to transform into someone or something else, a sort of AT castaway, a trail animal. I was haggard, bony, and somehow permanently dirty, but I would need to dig even deeper into that bony body if I was going to get to Maine. New Jersey. It was hard to believe we had made it this far. The runners and hikers came out in force, giving us an enthusiastic welcome, Jersey accent and all. Signs saying, "New Jersey loves El Venado," were taped around trees. I was more than halfway done, and the distances between states got smaller, and the trail supposedly easier, according to Horty. The mid-Atlantic states brought with them the almost instant gratification of daily border crossings. New Jersey, New York, then Connecticut, which signaled our arrival in New England. Connecticut and Massachusetts would each take a day. It was Vermont, New Hampshire, and then Maine that had humbled many a thru-hiker. They were the undisputed crux of the entire AT. It was heartening to look at a full AT map and see how much ground we'd covered. I loved feeling the progress and knowing how far I had traveled by human locomotion. The squiggly red line that went from where I was to the end of the Appalachian Trail was getting shorter and shorter. It was a good thing, too, because by the time Jalu and I ran across the Delaware River, I was starting to feel an obstruction that was hard to describe. Not the early wall I'd hit a few days in, and not a mental wall or a sense of doubt or the physical barriers of injury and crippling soreness. It was a heaviness, an imaginary 50-pound pack that felt all too real. It was in the Kittanny Mountains in New Jersey that I struggled with the daily despair of, how can I keep doing this for another 2 weeks? It was a strange form of depression. I would be happy throughout the day, with some ups and downs. Running and hiking tens of miles a day isn't always a joyful experience. I would finish the day flying high on the satisfaction of completing another 50-plus mile day. That moment of glory would last a few minutes, and then I'd feel a sinking sensation as I remembered that in less than 6 hours, I would be waking up to do the same thing again. I was caught up in a cycle of emotions every damn day. The runner who patiently waited outside Castle Black at 6 o'clock that morning was bubbling with excitement. But I told him I might not say much as we ran. I couldn't confide in him. I couldn't even confide in Jalu, because she had her own emotional roller coaster to deal with. And I sure as hell didn't know how to describe it to the data-driven goat, even though he probably knew exactly how I felt. He had been there, and he'd cracked. Maybe this was how depressed people felt. I could put on the happy face, soak up motivation from those who came out to run with me and cheer for me, feel the power of my legs propelling me, but deep down inside, I was faltering, sinking. There was one other person I needed in my corner. He had seen me at the height of my career and at the darkest times during my divorce. He'd helped me climb up and out of that, and now he might be able to lift me up, push me forward, regardless of the heaviness I felt. Don Mukai was like an adopted father to me. I valued his expertise. He was a runner too, but what I really needed was his comforting paternal presence. He was the opposite of Horty and Carl. He was a genteel, agreeable, buttoned-up attorney from Seattle. But he was also as strong as steel. He'd trained extensively in the martial arts. His own teacher had been trained by the karate legend Anichi Miyagi, the inspiration for Mr. Miyagi in The Karate Kid. And that legacy seemed to live on in Don. He carried himself with that same zen-like dignity, but he could quickly switch to Mortal Kombat mode. Don practiced a form of Okinawan karate called Goju Ryu, a discipline whose adherents could do things like catch arrows and break concrete blocks with their bare hands. I thought that was the stuff of movies from my youth, but then he showed me pictures of himself breaking through stacks of wood boards. Years ago, he had introduced me to the Japanese philosophy of Bushido, or the way of the warrior, which stressed honor, simplicity, and courage. There are echoes of its lessons in the stoicism of Marcus Aurelius, especially in the tenet that has most influenced me. The mind of a warrior, or anyone performing a difficult task, should be so attuned to the moment that thoughts and emotions do not impede proper action. A mind in this condition is thought to function so optimally that the right decisions come naturally, and pain and fear disappear. I often saw similarities between this mindset and what elite athletes refer to as being in the zone. When I successfully adopted the mind of the warrior, I felt a great sense of mustness replace my confusion and anxiety. I must keep going, no question. Was I going to release my heaviness or carry it the rest of the way north? Was I even going to make it to Maine, much less break the record for doing it? I had no idea, literally. I had no idea in my head beyond the overwhelming must. Keep going. It's as easy as that. A single focal point. Keep going. Stay in the now. Every moment contains only one thing. The potential to keep going. JLu intuitively understood what I was going through on some level, even more than Horty and Speedgoat did, and she emailed Don and included a list of provisions he should try to bring. When he arrived at the trail, she was so happy to see him that she almost cried. Having an old friend she could trust to look out for us, she finally let her guard down. I wasn't so much happy to see him as relieved. Just knowing he was coming had already started to lighten me. Once he settled into our crew, he displayed the goods he'd graciously brought from Seattle. Everything JLu had requested, and about 5 times the amount she had asked for. It was generous and overwhelming. He'd packed a giant box of delicate Japanese pastries that had already begun to spoil. He also brought the special type of vegan cinnamon roll she'd wanted for me, a 2,000-calorie loaf that was shaped like a baguette. In fact, he had 6 of them. Because of the summer heat and the size of our compact cooler, many of his gifts had to be smashed, folded, and crammed into the cooler. It was a tragedy, but Castle Black was a war room, not a pantry. It's funny in retrospect, but the situation challenged us at the time. Don, wonderful Don, had brought exactly what I needed most in that moment: stability, authority, grace, and groundedness. He almost instantaneously shook me out of my depression, and I was grateful once again for his ability to intervene in my life and make me focus on the here and now. And then, the reality of the AT overtook us all, Don especially. Within a day, it became clear that Bushido Don was not ready for the gnarly old AT, and we were not ready for Don's unreadiness. To add more senseis to the mix, Horty had returned to the trail after biking the Tour Divide race for only a few days. Stomach problems, he'd said, and he ended the discussion. Now we had two AT veterans on deck, each with his own expertise and dogma. It was fun to watch them jockey for the title of chief officer. Although they probably didn't want to admit it, we all knew Jalu was the ship's master. Prior to this, the two had spent little time side by side, although Horty was there when the Speed Goat pulled the plug on his own AT attempt in 2014. And of course, old Horty had his own opinion on that scene. If Horty wasn't sliding open Castle Black's door at 5 a.m. with a, "Let's go to Maine, boy!" wake-up call, Speed Goat was simply knocking on the van wall 10 minutes before he'd be back with a cup of hot coffee, as he pointed me directions to his camping toilet seat somewhere deep in the woods, often engulfed in knee-high poison ivy. Speed Goat was immune to its itchy oils. He had started digging a hole despite grumbling to us later.
"Dude, you think bears dig holes?"
Spigo kept showing us his graphs and charts, explaining that I needed to cover more miles to make it to this or that landmark or road crossing if I wanted to own the FKT. Each chief officer brought something different to the table. One brought grit and irrepressibility, the other obsessive calculation and strategizing, and they were both crazy as hell. On the afternoon of day 28, we left the Garden State and entered New York, which some hikers on the AT call Little Maine, for its networks of ladders over mossy boulders, rock scrambles, and root infestations. The foothills of New York felt as remote as any place on the trail. I don't know what special magic lived there, but the darkness was darker and the night was more solemn and more thorough than anywhere else. I couldn't believe that New York City was just 30-some miles away. Perhaps the trail's proximity to the busiest place on Earth made it that much darker. If the weather cooperated, the next day I'd be able to see the city's vast skyline. I felt like I was on another planet, but in reality, I was a short train ride from Times Square. To add to our problems, a fierce windstorm had recently plowed through the area and uprooted thick, towering trees that were now scattered throughout the woods and across the trail. We had to climb over them, crawl under them, or wade into the dense forest to go around them. Just as in Maine, blazes on the trail were infrequent and tricky to spot, and the downed trees added another dimension to trail travel. If this was a little taste of Maine, I was in for a real treat in 500 miles. As we crossed a slab of granite, Cordy and I had roused a couple of very large, gorgeous, emerald-tinted rattlesnakes. Even Horty marveled at their beauty. He had stopped crushing them with rocks years ago. I joked that he was turning into a peace-loving hippie. For someone so stubborn, old Horty surprised me with his potential for change. Like with Horty, this wasn't Bushido Don's first rodeo. He had supported me on numerous 100-mile races and was a fully qualified and valued crew ninja. However, the crewing of an AT speed record is a whole different mission. Sometimes a team member's qualities may have worked seamlessly on previous projects. But if you change the project scope, that trusted team member may struggle and affect the team's dynamics. I needed Don's presence, but he was adding another stressor. Not to me, but to the rest of our tight crew. He was constantly getting lost and couldn't follow Castle Black, even though it was the only large black van for miles and miles. At one trailhead, Gracious Don offered to take trash from thru-hikers and asked Horty where the trash went. Horty said, "It goes nowhere." Instead of nurturing us, Bushido Don needed his sword held. He was in over his head and was stressing Jalu out. She confided in me that it was too much for them, that they didn't have the bandwidth to take care of me and my sensei. With mutiny on the horizon, I had to tell him one warning, that he needed to Bushido focus on following Jenny. She couldn't wait for him or give him directions to remote trailheads narrowly found. I felt bad. I probably didn't have the best delivery, and Don was the last person I wanted to hurt. Bushido Don meant well, and he did well most of the time. I felt responsible. I hadn't given him a warning of what he might walk into on the green tunnel. It was like jumping into the middle of a work project. I couldn't give him a training manual ahead of time, like he once did for me with a copy of The Book of Five Rings by Musashi. And there was no time for Jaylu, Speed Goat, or Horty to do on-the-job training. Sometimes you keep a team member on because you know they are needed. Don was needed by me. So being the master team leaders they were, Jaylu and Speed Goat figured a way to work with Don for the next few days before he left, giving him clear and direct instructions. Most often, these were the Mr. Miyagi-style tasks of wax on, wax off, like peeling a case of mangoes that we had been given. Jaylu knew plenty about single-minded focus, and I had plenty of experience with that, too.
That storm Speed Goat had warned us about arrived, and it had a name, Tropical Storm Bill. It rolled into York County, Pennsylvania, around the same time we did on day 25. It was a Saturday, so there was a crowd of runners with Scott all morning. But as Bill started dumping almost 2 inches of rain, the locals rapidly thinned out, and I needed to come up with a plan. I knew Jerker would be finishing a 52-mile day soaking wet, and he'd be lucky to be done before midnight. I looked in the guidebook and saw that down the road from our ending location was an organic farm called Common Ground Farm and Retreat. It sounded like our kind of place. Speedgoat had never heard of it, a rarity, so he couldn't vouch for it. I knew Jerker would appreciate a hot shower and a real bed after this giant effort. Not only that, a vegan bakery in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania had reached out about delivering Scott some treats. The owner dropped off 2 giant boxes filled with the kind of desserts you see at weddings and fancy hotels. I knew this organic sanctuary coupled with the vegan treats was going to soften the blow of this long and soggy nighttime push. We checked into the retreat that evening. I expected Jerker to arrive around 11 p.m., so around 10:15, I walked out of the room and looked for Speed Goat. He had parked and leveled his van in front of the main lodge, and I thought he was going to come with me so he could run back on the trail to meet Scott. But as I got closer to his van, I saw he was not in running clothes, but freshly showered and curled up in his sleeping bag, reading his guidebooks and jotting down notes, so I decided not to bother him. I drove alone to the trailhead, but before I got there, my phone rang. I looked at the caller ID. It was Jerker. Panic. If he has time to call me, it means he's not moving. He never calls me. The rain was coming down in sheets that the headlights were reflecting off, so it was difficult to see where I was going. I couldn't answer the phone, and he left a voicemail. I kept driving toward the trail, and a few minutes later, I saw headlamps and people waving me down. It was Jerker and 3 other runners. They had been waiting for me for only 5 minutes, but I felt terrible. In this kind of weather, after that kind of day, I knew how disheartening it must have been for them to reach the road and not see anybody there. I would have been so mad if the tables were turned. But not Jerker. He waved at me enthusiastically and thanked his local companions, and they left to run back to their cars 5 miles down the trail. He wasn't mad at all. He'd just been worried about me. I drove us back to the farm. Our friend had driven down from New York, and he'd brought Thai food. After Scott took a hot shower, we ate pad Thai noodles and curry together, and then Jerker finally lay down in a proper-sized bed and dug into the pastries. Jerker was in paradise. He was holding a Boston cream donut in one hand and a chocolate chip cannoli in the other. I put on my headlamp and started doing our nightly tick check. If I'd been in the van where it was a lot darker, I would have missed it. There, on his left bicep, was the tiniest tick I had ever seen, smaller than a pinhead. At first, I thought it was a speck of dirt, slightly raised, so I tried to flick it away. It didn't move. The head was already buried in Scott's skin. I let out a whispered scream. "Jerker! A tick!" "What?" Are you serious? Yes! I ran outside in the rain to Castle Black and dug around for our first aid kit. I found the tick removal tool and followed the instructions, but the tick was so small, the tool was useless. I grabbed tweezers from my toiletry bag and carefully pulled it out. Holy cow, let me see that thing. It's so tiny, how did you even see it? I wonder if I got it when I took a nap in a pile of leaves off the trail. You did what? I was stunned. That was the most idiotic thing he'd ever done. I threw the covers off him and doubled my efforts to find ticks on his hairy legs. I found two more that had burrowed into his shins. How could you be so stupid? Have you lost your mind? What is wrong with you? Don't you know that our lives go on after this trail? Hello? Remember me? I need you when this is over. Lyme disease can mess you up, and I need you. Our future family needs you. I don't care if you're so tired you can't walk. Don't you ever lie down in the leaves again. The storm passed and it was hot and humid in our final days of Pennsylvania. Yes, it was rocky, but getting through Pennsylvania was a huge transition for us. We started to feel the population density close in around us. More people, more houses, more road crossings, and better food. It was in Pennsylvania that the vegetarian community really showed up. One lady brought us a dozen black bean burgers. Another guy made us raw vegan cookies. Somebody else brought a bag of homemade granola. All comforts that we appreciated. But apparently, not everybody was up on the latest evolutions of plant-based foods. I heard from people about some chatter on Facebook that Scott wasn't following a vegan diet anymore. I can only guess that some visitors saw things in the van that didn't look vegan, like the cream puffs and burger patties. But I couldn't worry about that. At every trailhead, whenever the van door was open, enthusiasts would stick their heads in, take photos and videos, and post whatever they wanted on the internet. I knew people were curious, but it basically sucked. Castle Black was our crew vehicle, but it was also my home, with my underwear, sports bra, and running clothes hanging to dry, dirty dishes everywhere, our unmade bed, and so on. Keeping our tradition alive, on day 27, Jerker and I crossed the Pennsylvania-New Jersey state line together at the Delaware Water Gap. It was a bluebird morning, and even though the trail paralleled a major highway, it was serene. After that, the border crossings came fast and furious. The next day we were in New York. Good old Hordy came back and found us in New York. Apparently, he'd ended his bike ride early. He didn't say why, and I didn't ask. I had my own theories. You know when you spark up a new relationship and you make any excuse to see that person? That was Hordy with the AT. Any chance he had to stop by and check on Scott's progress, he jumped at the opportunity. On the morning of day 29, Hordy and I met Jerker outside of Harriman State Park. He was running with some locals, and Hordy razzed them as they crossed the road and started climbing up a hill. Hordy and I were discussing the game plan for the day when we heard voices and this loud, "Damn it!" Then we saw Jerker running down toward us with the group of locals trailing behind him. Apparently, Jerker had been following the locals when he stopped and said, "Hey, I haven't seen any blazes in a while. Are we still on the AT?" Before they could answer, he had already turned around. It wasn't far, but they had climbed uphill for about a quarter of a mile on the wrong trail. We saw him retrace his steps back to the AT and cringed. Everybody means well, but you still can't let your guard down. In the end, he was responsible for covering every step of the trail on his own. I drove to Bear Mountain State Park to meet Jerker. I hadn't realized it was a steep 2.5 miles to the summit where we planned to meet, and I thought for sure I was going to miss him. When I reached the top, there were news vans and a lot of runners hanging around. I found Scott sitting on a rock wearing a fluorescent yellow mesh vest that said, "Guide," next to a guy wearing a similar vest that said, Blind Runner. They were doing an interview for a local TV crew. Turker introduced me to his friend Thomas, whom he had guided at the Boston Marathon just a few months ago. From the summit of Bear Mountain, we could see the Manhattan skyline. Such a strange juxtaposition. We'd been to New York City countless times, and I'd never realized how close it was to the AT and its rugged trails. A doctor friend of ours who has a house close to the AT met us on the trail. She was a well-known OBGYN in Soho. We'd gotten to know her on a trip we'd taken to Tanzania earlier that year with an organization called Every Mother Counts, a nonprofit that aimed to make pregnancy and childbirth safe for every mother, everywhere. Its mission became very close to us after my first miscarriage, when the nearness of the hospital, just a mile away, was critical to saving my life. I was relieved to see the OBGYN, Dr. Flagg, because I'd started to worry about my own health. 2 months had passed since I'd had my DNC surgery after the miscarriage, and I still hadn't gotten my period. When I asked her what she thought about that, she said the average time for the uterus to heal could vary, but 8 weeks was a bit on the long side. In other words, don't worry, but keep me posted.
New England, 452 miles. I love the fight, and when things are easy, I hate it. Ernest Shackleton. Chapter 11, Nasty. Day 29. Bet you didn't think you'd see a black dude out here in these woods. He was up above me, sitting on a large rock that overhung the trail. I could make out his spiked dreadlocks and a green running singlet that had black roses NYC printed across the front. We were about 30 miles north of New York City in Bear Mountain State Park. I just laughed. Remember me, brother? We ran 31 miles around Manhattan when you were here for your book a few years back, he said, climbing down. Knox? No way. That's crazy. I was surprised to see him, but now I knew exactly who he was. Knox was one of those guys you just do not forget. I immediately thought back to the run we did together. He told me he had to meet me because I quoted Tupac in Eat and Run. I remembered how cool the Black Roses running group sounded. Knox was the leader, and he seemed to have a curator's touch in bringing together interesting, disparate groups of people. It was part book club, part elite track team, part motorcycle gang. I wanted to be a member, but I didn't know if I was boss enough. We reminisced about the run we'd done in New York City years ago, and discussed my State of the Union and the FKT. The miles clicked by, barely noticed. We talked about the history of our sport, and we talked about someone we both deeply admired. Ted Corbett, the legendary African-American ultrarunner and Olympic marathoner. Running with Knox gave a boost to my spirits. I set aside my way of the warrior worldview and slipped into what might have been an even more powerful mindset. Having fun. Shooting the shit. We didn't even stop when Knox bonked hard. He wouldn't eat any of my gels. And we were only somewhat phased when a thru-hiker named Karaoke joined us for 18 miles, 20-pound pack and all. Karaoke earned his nickname. He wasn't exactly an opera singer, but we enjoyed his company nonetheless. There must have been something in the water up there in the Hudson Valley, because the trail was full of colorful characters. On the way to a little shelter near Fishkill, on the east side of the Hudson, we passed one totally naked thru-hiker, holding a strategically placed sign that read, Hey, Scott Jurek, this sausage is vegan. The next day in Connecticut, I knew what Speed Goat was probably thinking. But I didn't stress. I was having fun for the first time in a long time. I even guided my blind buddy Thomas for 2 miles to the summit of Bear Mountain, which inspired me. Besides all the new runners, there was something else changing around me. I could feel it in my bones. The river sounded different, stronger, louder, meaner. Evergreens were becoming more prevalent. Even the rocks were different. I don't know how to describe them, although you'd think I would have been a geologist by this point, given all the billions of rocks I'd seen the past 30 days. The AT was shape-shifting, and I could feel it. I tried to share this observation with Speed Goat as we cut through the beautiful Housatonic Valley that runs through New York, Connecticut, and Massachusetts. He was predictably unmoved. I was out here for adventure, but Speed Goat was out here with one thing on his mind. There was no time during an FKT for musing about the trees and rocks. To him, everything was another benchmark, another box to check. I wondered if there was time for him to wax poetic. On day 30, we'd crossed into New England, his homeland. But for him, Connecticut was just another state on the AT, one that we'd be through in a day. Just another chance to get a few more miles completed on mellower terrain before, as he ominously put it,
shit gets real.
Old Horty understood what I meant, but to him, it wasn't a mystery. He met me at one of the many crossings of River Road in Connecticut, and I hollered out to him. You can feel the rivers changing. It's different up here. Almost like we've crossed into another realm. You bet, boy. I was wondering if you could tell. You're heading to the big mountains, and you're gonna love it. Day 32 dawned in Massachusetts, and I could sense Speed Goat silently bursting with the pent-up energy of,
I told you so.
I hadn't finished until midnight yesterday, and I wasn't gonna finish much earlier tonight. Speed Goat had stopped staying up for me days before back in New York. I finally started imposing some discipline on myself when it came to other runners. Speed Goat probably would have counseled me to turn off that fucking tracker, but I needed to stay true to myself. So instead of adopting any kind of fake coldness or rudeness, I just got efficient. Rather than stopping for photo ops, I asked that people take their pictures on the go. Selfies were fine, but they had to keep up as they snapped them. I wasn't going to break stride anymore. It felt good. I didn't turn anyone away, but I managed to put my and my team's priorities first. I felt like it was the kind of middle way that should have pleased everyone. Of course it didn't. Speed Goat still rolled his eyes when I signed a book or took a pic, even on the run. But his hardline approach wouldn't matter soon, because he was about to take off. It was time for him to get to the Hard Rock 100. I could tell he was antsy about leaving, and he spent the last several days poring over maps and crunching numbers like he was cramming for a final exam. Right before he left, he asked if he could have a private powwow with me. I had been dealing with extreme nausea and fever while running all morning, and I was worried a virus or stomach bug was settling in, but I needed to get every last piece of trail wisdom Speed Goat had to offer. I asked the half dozen or so runners with me if they could give Speed Goat and me some space for the next mile.
Horty and I have a master plan. We got you scheduled all the way to Katahdin. Gonna have to plow through 50-mile days in Vermont, but things let up into manageable high 30s in the Whites and Mahoosics. Just keep doing what you're doing.
He filled me in on the numbers and mileage goals. As he outlined the plan, I realized he really, truly did not want to leave us. I knew he would anyway. He couldn't skip Hard Rock, but I could feel his regret and anxiety. I understood. Even though my name would be on the FKT if I actually made it, this was his adventure too. He was invested. To walk away? Especially now when I was gaining momentum, but also, in his view, taking big risks. It was eating him up. I had noticed a similar dynamic in play with people who'd never even been out here on the trail. Social media had connected thousands and thousands of people to our FKT, and it was shocking to me how deeply many of them were invested in the run. JLU and I were constantly getting requests for more photos, more updates, more. Followers online would observe my progress throughout the whole day. They woke up with me, they went to work with me, and they went to sleep wondering how far I would push through the night. It was another reminder that I was running with the collective ambitions and hopes of a lot more people than I'd ever anticipated. With Speed Goat and Bushido Don gone, Jenny and I were briefly down to a skeleton crew. I'd been averaging a little over 50 miles a day for the past week despite the rough terrain, which was good. Not good enough, but good. I was holding steady, but not making up additional ground. The idea that I was going to build up any more of a cushion on the record was beginning to seem more and more impossible. The days were ticking by. But first, we had to get into those big mountains that Horty had talked about back at the Housatonic River. Just as the team got low on personnel, my longtime buddy Walter came in, fresh from the corporate world, ready to escape his high-stress work life by getting muddy and destroyed in Massachusetts and Vermont. We started day 32 running through the Sages Ravine in Massachusetts. It was a magical section of trail, pristine, verdant, and prehistoric. The trail lies deep in a quiet gully shaded by an old forest, and it's lined with glaciated boulders that have been sanded smooth by millions of years of ice, wind, and water. It felt like someone could have run this same route a few thousand years before us. It had a mystifying ancient feel to it. We made good time, and by late in the day we were making our way to Mount Greylock, the highest point in Massachusetts at 3,500 feet. We ran 51 miles that day, and much of it was dark, cold, and wet. A storm blowing in from the Midwest announced its impending arrival. Meteorologists were calling it an atmospheric river, and it had been kicking up 120-mile-an-hour winds and bringing tornadoes, drenching rains, floods, hail, and mudslides to much of the country. The forecast for Boston was for winds of 50 miles an hour, and possibly a tornado. I thought of the mile-long mudholes of Vermont that I'd heard so much about, and those were supposedly on a good day. They were probably turning into ponds of morass now. Walter and I ran past Pittsfield in the beautiful Berkshires, the town where Herman Melville had written Moby Dick, and a group of locals fell in line with us. One was a talker. He wanted to know what we had seen, how we were feeling, how many miles we were planning for the day, what we thought about Massachusetts. Then he wanted to talk about startups and the problems with a lot of technology and the beauty of data. Were we running for a charity? And if so, could he donate? And had I heard about the weather coming in? I don't think he took a breath. Finally, Walter spoke up. "Dude," he said, "you sure can talk." "Oh yeah," the guy answered. "My friends call me Word Count." It turned out that one of those friends was four-time Boston Marathon champion, Bill Rogers. And as we ran through the town of Cheshire, he got him on the phone. It was surreal. The legendary Boston Billy was giving me words of encouragement as I ran along the AT. After that, we felt more comfortable asking for some quiet time. We figured he was used to people requesting that. And when Word Count peeled off in Cheshire, Walter and I got to catch up in earnest. Walter was the opposite of Speed Goat. He didn't care about numbers or hard facts. If Speed Goat were a TV show, he would be something on C-SPAN, whereas Walter would be a reality show on E. He was mindless entertainment for me, and knew me on a different level. He wasn't a fellow competitor, and he finished hours after me in races. He had once weighed close to 300 pounds and lived a real all-or-nothing life. He'd had a lot of fun, which J.Lew and I vicariously enjoyed after we'd settled down. He transformed his life in an incredible way and got sober and stable. He could then be my wingman and designated driver when I needed to go out in Seattle after my divorce. I'd party and he'd throw back soda water, having just as much fun as me, until we closed down the bars. He was a great friend, one who I could confide in. I've always loved hanging out with people who'd manifested their own destinies, people who have made things happen despite the odds. There are no better runners, no better human beings. At least they're the people I like to roll with. And often, they weren't the fastest runners or the most successful. They endured, and they were real to the core. On the trail, I let Walter's Tinder updates and his stories of the latest dating scene entertain me. He filled me in on the Boulder gossip and told me what our friends were up to. It was a world I felt so far removed from, yet I remembered it well. We ran and hiked as if we were on a training run, catching up with each other with no worries and no places to be. It was just Walter and me for the night shift of day 32, a 3,000-foot climb up Greylock. As we neared the summit, the wind screamed and pushed huge clouds of fog through the evergreens. It was summer and hours before sunset, but the trail went dark as midnight. Walter and I felt like we were back in the Seattle foothills of Tiger Mountain, where we'd both spent many wet, dark miles. We laughed at how running those tough miles were some of our fondest memories, the ones full of type 2 fun that you appreciated after they were over. By the time we dragged ourselves to the summit of Mount Greylock, the winds were gusting to 60 miles an hour, the temperature had dropped to 40 degrees, and we were soaked with icy water, exhausted and starving. Jaylu cooked us some pasta with marinara sauce and Kalamata olives, and the van trembled and shook in the gale. I told Walter to forget about the tent he had intended to set up, and to find some floor space in Castle Black, El Coyote style. For nearly an hour, we had the coziest little dinner party in all of Massachusetts. It was one of those perfect nights where the screeching bleak weather outside only made the warmth inside more pervasive. We ate to our heart's content, tried to remember some of the crazier things word count had said, and pressed Walter for more stories from his wild dating life. Three old friends laughing and eating and talking about failed dates and awkward hookups, all on the top of a mountain in the middle of a storm, crammed into a dirty van whose wheels were just barely holding on to the earth. Three old friends and Horty. An icy gust of rain blew into the van as a sliding door opened, and Horty's voice, ferocious as the gales outside, rattled the van.
Hey, boy, better try and get some sleep. Vermont is going to be real nasty.
Horty said the word nasty with a pirate's breathy gusto. He loved to launch into his new and wild adventures when seas were at their highest. Horty relished the gnar. To him, true adventure should be steeped with elements of failure, risk, and even death, preferably all three. He was especially fond of the Shackleton quote, "I love the fight, and when things are easy, I hate it." He was right about Vermont. I knew it. I was exhausted, but as I drifted off, I saw the fields and forest of Vermud, as Vermont was known, turning wetter and muddier and wetter and muddier. Horty the soothsayer. Horty, the piratical harbinger of doom. Things were going to get real nasty. It was nice to have a night to forget about it.
Crewing for a 100-mile race has its challenges, but it's usually over in a day. I'd been crewing for Jerker on the Appalachian Trail for an entire month straight. Every time Luis or Horty came back, he would remark, "I can't believe you're still out here." To be honest, I couldn't either. I know that Horty's wife, Nancy, didn't crew for him on the AT, and Speedgoat's wife, Cheryl, crewed a couple of sections. I understood why. Since I was Scott's only constant crew, and neither of us had an opportunity to take any real breaks, it meant that both members of our typically happy household were reaching their limits at exactly the same time. We were both stressed. We were both sleeping poorly. We were both sacrificing so much. It was hard for us to support each other in any meaningful way. Some stressors were avoidable. Some people weren't. I loved everybody on our team and appreciated all the people who came out, but every once in a while, I wanted some alone time with my husband. It felt like we never had a single moment of privacy anymore, and I was actually starting to get a little jealous of the friends and fans who got to run long stretches with him all day. He had promised me we could run the next section together alone, but when Jerker arrived, a few local runners were already with him and more were waiting to join. I gave him a look that said, "I need to talk to you, alone." And he gave me that, "Not now, I'm busy," look right back, without hesitation. Then he invited the next group of runners to join him. I gave him another look, one that said, "Oh no, you didn't." After a month of waiting on him hand and foot, I felt completely disrespected. I gave the van keys to Walter and took off running down the trail. There was a side trail, and I knew he thought I'd taken that because I heard him calling my name. "Jaylu! Jaylu!" Good. I hoped he went down that trail looking for me. I was in full sabotage mode now. I kept running as fast as I could just to make the point that he didn't deserve my company. I descended a series of bluffs, and after a few switchbacks, I no longer heard his voice in the distance. He must have gotten the hint and told the runners he needed some privacy. I heard him calling after me some more. Jaylu! Jaylu! Once I hit the base of the bluffs, it was relatively flat and I tore through the trees even faster. I muttered between breaths, "I will break you," and ran for my life. I was pushing myself, and the surprising, annoying thing was, he was gaining on me. I knew he'd been feeling good, but not that good. How was that possible? He inevitably caught me, and I stopped. I was silent, yet poised to bound off again as I waited to see what his first move would be. It felt like we were back on the PCT, having a blowout fight about everything and nothing at once. "Jaylu, I'm sorry. I know I should have told them they couldn't run with me, but what was I supposed to say? No, I'm sorry, you can't run with me today. I need to talk to my wife in private." Yes, that would have been a perfect thing to say. People have to understand they can't always run with you whenever they want to. I'm so sick of you not standing up for me, not giving our relationship space. This is my trip too, remember? Without giving him a chance to respond, I grabbed the tracker out of his vest pocket and held it in the air, scanning for the nearest cliff. Unfortunately, we were on a flat and wide section of trail. Undaunted, I cocked my arm back and prepared to chuck it as far into the trees as I could. At the top of my lungs, I shouted, "It's me or the tracker!" His eyes widened. "No! Jaylu, don't!" Another big storm blew in, along with a high wind advisory for eastern Massachusetts. Jerker and Walter were slogging their way up Mount Greylock, battling rain, mud, and gusts reaching 45 miles an hour in town and closer to 60 miles an hour near the summit. Par for the course, this was our storm du jour. Speedgoat flew home, but was following our progress and always available for remote consultations. I didn't throw the tracker into the woods. I made my point, and Jerker understood. We were a team, and there was no time for holding grudges. We had other things to worry about. On day 33, the torment raged on while we ran over and under storm-down trees and right into the town of North Adams, tucked up in the northwestern corner of Massachusetts. In a wonderful coincidence, there was a music festival going on there that weekend that our friend Timmy O'Neill was emceeing. He was planning on joining our team, so we met up in the parking lot of a Big J grocery store. I had never been so happy to see him. We were old climbing buddies from my college days in Boulder, and over the years he'd become a best friend and mentor. He'd actually presided over our marriage on a hillside in Sunshine Canyon. Seeing Timmy on that blustery afternoon after a month of that grind was a huge morale boost for me, and I knew he would provide the same for Scott. Even better, his MC gig was almost up, and he was free to join our team the very next day. Jerker had been referring to Timmy as his secret weapon for weeks now. Everybody warned us about the White Mountains and their granite slabs and peaks. We had heard stories of exposed cliffs, and while Scott admitted he had a slight fear of heights, he always downplayed it. Unfortunately, I had seen with my own eyes how bad it truly was. When I worked for Patagonia in Ventura, California, I would routinely make the six-hour drive out to our friend Dean Potter's shabin. That was his term, a cross between a shack and a cabin, in Yosemite for the weekend. Ever since those days, climbing the regular northwest face of Yosemite's famous Half Dome had been a dream of mine. Dean had promised me that if I trained for it, he would guide me up the route. Jerker knew this was an opportunity I couldn't pass up, and he was psyched to help make it happen in June of 2011.